Morning.
Morning, Your Honors. Mr. Olson, may it please the Court. Before you this morning is a single judgment comprised of two component parts against Taya Kyle, the executor of the estate of her husband, the late Chris Kyle. First, the jury award of $500,000 for defamation, and second, an award of more than $1.3 million made by the trial judge sitting in equity for unjust enrichment. In our briefs, we provided multiple reasons why neither component part of that judgment can survive this appeal, and I'm prepared to answer any questions the Court may have about any of them. If left to my own devices, however, I propose to focus my argument this morning on three of them. First, the trial judge's failure to instruct the jury that Mr. Ventura was required to prove material falsity by clear and convincing evidence, and the consequences of that failure for the independent review of the record evidence of material falsity that this court is obliged by the First Amendment to conduct. Second, the trial court's unprecedented decision to recognize a cause of action under Minnesota law for unjust enrichment based entirely on the publication of a defamatory falsehood. And third, the trial judge's failure to grant a mistrial after Mr. Ventura's counsel expressly and improperly argued to the jury in his closing that an insurance company was, and I quote, on the hook if it found that Mr. Ventura had been defamed. I'll start with material falsity. At trial, the district court rejected Mrs. Kyle's request that the jury be instructed that Mr. Ventura's burden of proof with respect to material falsity on his defamation claim was by clear and convincing evidence. The trial court's failure to do so was incorrect as a matter of law, and all apart from the cumulative impact of the other incorrect instructions addressed in our briefs, and the jury's repeated questions to the court during its deliberations manifesting its confusion with respect to those very issues, that single failure irretrievably taints the jury's verdict.
How many times did the jury inquire of the court during their deliberations?
I'm sorry, say that again.
How many times did the jury inquire of the court during their deliberations?
I believe it was three. It may have been four. There was a question about Instruction 8 with respect to what the reference to a story meant. There was the question about what serious doubt as to the truth meant with respect to actual malice. And there was a question about whether they had to find that Mr. Kyle, whether the statements were false or whether Mr. Kyle believed that the statements were false. And I think there might have been a fourth one where they expressed just general confusion with respect to Instruction number 8. Your Honors, as the Supreme Court held in Mason versus New Yorker magazine and reaffirmed just last year in Ayer, Wisconsin versus Hooper, the issues of actual malice and material falsity in a public figure defamation case like this one are inextricably intertwined. In both those cases, the court not only held that the former can't exist without the latter, but further emphasized that material falsity is a component part of the actual malice definition itself. Not surprisingly, the overwhelming majority of courts that have addressed the issue, especially in the wake of Mason and Ayer, Wisconsin, have held that material falsity must be proved by the same clear and convincing evidence required to ground a finding of actual malice. Most recently, the Tenth Circuit in the Broker's Choice versus NBC case. In this case specifically, arising as it does.
Are we looking at federal law, U.S. Supreme Court law here, or Minnesota law?
No.
We're looking at this federal law.
Yes, Your Honor. This is an issue of First Amendment law, and our submission is that, if nothing else, the Supreme Court's decisions in Mason and Ayer, Wisconsin, plus the weight of authority from the lower courts on the issue, requires.
Well, even though it's a state defamation claim, your argument, at least you're arguing now, is a First Amendment issue.
Correct. This issue is a First Amendment issue. And it's especially important in this case, Your Honor, because this case arises from a defendant's firsthand accounts of events in which he personally participated. In a case like that, a predicate jury finding of material falsity made under only a preponderance of the evidence standard will inevitably and improperly lead to a finding of actual malice in every case.
Well, counsel, in this case, didn't the district court say its conclusion was based on the higher standard as opposed to preponderance?
In a footnote in its decision on the post-trial motions, Your Honor, it said without much explanation that it would have found that there was clear and convincing evidence of material falsity. But that doesn't matter here for two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, if nothing else, under the Seventh Amendment, Mrs. Kyle is entitled to a jury trial under the correct evidentiary standard. And second, this court, of course, under the First Amendment, has an obligation to undertake its own independent review of the record evidence and determine for itself whether there was clear and convincing evidence of material falsity. And what the district court had to say about that issue is simply not relevant to this court's own independent review of that subject. Your Honors, with respect to this issue, I would call your attention to both the amicus brief jointly submitted to this court.
Let me ask you this. If we're doing an independent, clear and convincing evidence review, what here do you believe that the plaintiff did not meet the clear and convincing on the evidence?
Your Honor, there are, if you look at the evidence that
and I'll just tell you, because the typical is you've got one group of witness saying one thing, one group saying the other. That's what the jury decides. In this case, certainly on the unjust enrichment claim, if it stands, that's the judge's trier of fact. So where does it not meet the burden?
Your Honor, there are two issues here that you need to keep in mind. One is you undertake in this case an independent review of the record evidence of material falsity. That's up to you to undertake an independent review. What the jury found is not relevant to that determination. The second issue is you need to look at it, as the Supreme Court said in the Anderson versus Liberty Lobby case, through the prism of the applicable evidentiary standard, in this case, the clear and convincing standard. And as this court held in the Cornell versus Nix case, which is cited in our reply brief at page 14, clear and convincing evidence must be so clear, direct, weighty, and convincing as to enable the fact finder to come to a clear conviction without hesitancy of the truth of the precise facts at issue. That means, as the Fifth Circuit held in the National Association of Government Employees case, also cited in our reply brief at 14, where the evidence is conflicting or could plausibly be interpreted either way, the party with the burden has not met it by clear and convincing evidence. Maybe it has by a preponderance, but not by clear and convincing evidence. And in this case, Your Honor, there was testimony on both sides, and both sides tried to impeach the others.
Fine-tune it a little more. Is what we're really looking at is whether there was actual malice?
That is a second issue, Your Honor, but the first issue, the predicate issue, is whether there was material falsity. And because the jury wasn't instructed under the proper standard with respect to the material falsity, or at the very least, Mrs. Kyle is entitled to a new trial under that issue. I would go further and say when this court undertakes its own independent appellate review with respect to that issue, it will not be able to find clear and convincing evidence as a matter of law. And I would say at the end of the day, the reason that's true is because among all the witnesses in the case that one party or another claimed were biased or had credibility problems, there were two witnesses to whom that did not apply. Neither Rosemary DeShazo nor her sister Laura had ever met Chris Kyle. That was undisputed. They were not his friends. They weren't his relatives. They didn't know him. They also didn't know Governor Ventura, and they had no motive to testify falsely against him. And the record's undisputed that neither of them were drinking heavily that night. Yet Rosemary DeShazo, a board-certified medical doctor, testified unequivocally that Mr. Ventura told her that night that a fallen SEAL, and I quote, probably deserved it. And her sister Laura, a senior official at the Utah State Department of Education, testified that she saw a man matching Mr. Ventura's description throw a punch at Jesse Ventura that night. Your Honors, I respectfully submit that evidence, standing alone, precludes a finding of clear and convincing evidence of material falsity as a matter of law. Let me turn to the unjust enrichment verdict, if I might. Your Honors, the parties in this case don't agree about much. But one thing they do agree on is that if you find in our favor on the defamation claim, the unjust enrichment cause of action must be dismissed as well. But even if the defamation claim survives in some form, the unjust enrichment judgment cannot be sustained as a matter of law. As I noted at the outset, the district court's judgment with respect to unjust enrichment is unprecedented. To our knowledge and to the knowledge of the authors of the two amicus briefs submitted on this issue, no court had ever before held that a plaintiff may recover damages for unjust enrichment based on the publication of a defamatory falsehood. Indeed, as those amicus briefs demonstrate, several courts have expressly rejected the very claim that Mr. Ventura seeks to assert here, and there are several related reasons for this. First, in Minnesota, as in most other jurisdictions, a successful claim for unjust enrichment requires a pre-existing implied or quasi-contractual relationship between the parties. That's Hornbook law, expressly articulated by the Minnesota Supreme Court in so many words in the Caldas versus Affordable Granite and Stone case as recently as 2013. Simply put, Your Honors, the entire rationale for the unjust enrichment cause of action is to prevent an injustice where, because of some loophole in the law of contracts, one party who has conferred a benefit on another through their dealings with each other is unjustly absolved from paying for the benefit he received. In this case, it's undisputed that there was no relationship between Chris Kyle and Jesse Ventura of any kind, much less one that would rise to the level of an implied or quasi-contract. Thus, as a matter of black-letter Minnesota law, Mr. Ventura has simply failed to state a claim for unjust enrichment. And, Your Honors, even if there had been the necessary pre-existing quasi-contractual relationship, the claim would nevertheless be invalid under Minnesota law because it indisputably arises from the publication of information about a matter of public concern, and that publication did not constitute commercial speech. That is, it wasn't an advertisement or an invitation to engage in a commercial transaction. That, Your Honors, is the dispositive holding of this court in the Ruzicka versus Condé Nast case, affirming on its merits the district court's decision that even in the presence of the requisite pre-existing contractual or quasi-contractual relationship, there an author's promise not to identify the plaintiff in a published article, there could be no cause of action under Minnesota law for unjust enrichment arising from non-commercial speech about a matter of public concern. And even if Ruzicka were not the binding precedent of this circuit, Mr. Ventura's unjust enrichment claim would fail for the further reason that he had an adequate remedy at law, obviating the entire rationale for an equitable remedy in the first place. In this case, in addition to his defamation claim, Mr. Ventura also sought an award of damages for misappropriation, and the jury was instructed at his request that such an award, if it were made, could include damages in the form of monies earned by the Kyle estate as a result of its misappropriation of Mr. Ventura's name and likeness. The misappropriation claim, therefore, constituted an adequate remedy at law for precisely the same damages under any definition of that term. And that's so also as a matter of well-settled law, regardless of the fact that the jury found against Mr. Ventura on his misappropriation claim. Finally, with respect to unjust enrichment, I'd like to say just a word about the First Amendment. The arguments I've made so far on unjust enrichment are state law arguments, but let me say just a word about the First Amendment. In the briefs you have before you, we in the amici have advanced what I believe are persuasive arguments why, even if Minnesota would recognize the cause of action for unjust enrichment in these circumstances, such a claim would nevertheless be precluded by the First Amendment. These arguments, I submit, are at a minimum serious ones, ones that should, at the very least, properly cause this court to construe state law in a manner that avoids the need to take on what would otherwise be a very serious constitutional issue. Put differently, in a case like this one, where it's undisputed that no court in Minnesota or anywhere else had ever applied the law of unjust enrichment to allegedly false and defamatory speech about public figures, a federal court should not lightly take the extraordinary step of so expanding the reach of the common law. Finally, let me say a word or two about insurance. It's our contention, Your Honors, that Mrs. Kyle is entitled, if nothing else, to a new trial because in his closing argument, Mr. Ventura's counsel stood before the jury and told its members that if it awarded his client damages based on a finding that he had been defamed, an insurance company, not Mrs. Kyle, would be, and I quote, on the hook for them. To be blunt, there is no conceivable excuse for this.
Well, counsel, the rule that excludes evidence of insurance coverage allows it for reasons other than simply to put in front of the jury that there's a source of repayment, that there's the potential for admission for bias. And the district court seemed to believe that was appropriate here, or that applied here. Why is that wrong? Why wasn't the court's conclusion that there was another reason for the admission here or for it not being excluded appropriate or an abuse of discretion?
The bias issue, Your Honor, just simply doesn't hold water. He claims he was entitled to mention insurance in his closing because, as a predicate during his case, he sought to cross-examine two employees of HarperCollins, the publisher of the book, about their alleged bias on the ground that their employer, HarperCollins, was the named insured under the same insurance policy that was providing a defense to Mrs. Kyle. There are several flaws with that argument. For one thing, both of the witnesses about whom he inquired on that subject, a publicist and an editor who knew nothing about such matters, wouldn't be expected to, testified exactly that, they knew nothing about whether there was an insurance policy or not, and they could not, therefore, have been biased because of it. For another, both of those witnesses freely testified that they worked closely with Chris Kyle in either the writing, editing, and or marketing of the book, and that they had warm feelings both for him and for his work. Under those circumstances, Your Honors, the suggestion that Mr. Ventura needed to reference these employees' attenuated connection to their employer's insurance policy is, again, to put it bluntly, well, just a pretext.
Who put insurance before the jury initially for the first time?
Mr. Ventura's counsel. He attempted to inquire of these witnesses about their...
It a contract. I thought mention of insurance is contained in a contract that was before the jury.
Your Honor, that's not... I know that's Mr. Ventura's contention, but that's not correct either. Mr. Kyle's publishing agreement was, in fact, in evidence, and buried in that agreement is a reference to insurance. But not only did Mr. Ventura never call that provision of the agreement to the jury, it was for good reason that he didn't, because it doesn't say what he claims it says. It provides only that if HarperCollins should decide to obtain insurance covering the book, which it was by no means obligated by the agreement to do, it would then be obligated to include Mr. Kyle as an additional insured under any such policy. But there was no evidence before the jury that such a policy was ever purchased or that Mr. Kyle was an insured pursuant to its terms.
The problem bothers me is that trial counsel never move for a mistrial at the moment. You know, there's some argument that when a statement like that is made, you have to object right away to bring the court's attention, because the court can either rule on a grant a mistrial or give a cautionary instruction, and there was no cautionary instruction at any time, as I understand, on the insurance. And so why isn't that a problem you have here, is that counsel waited until the closing arguments were over and then made the motion?
Your Honor, immediately after closing argument. Now, what happened was, without taking a breath, after Mr. Ventura's counsel sat down, the judge proceeded to instruct the jury. But immediately after the jury instructions, before the jury went off, I guess the jury had just gone off to deliberate, but at that moment, Mrs. Kyle's counsel promptly stood up and moved for a mistrial. He had previously objected to the questioning of the two witnesses on the issue of the insurance policy. Those objections were overruled, and promptly after both of those witnesses testified.
Okay, I understand that. I understand that what happened. My question is, was it necessary under our rules to make the objection at the time?
I'm aware of no rule or case that says you have to interrupt the closing in the middle of the closing to make the objection. So long as it was made promptly afterwards, which it was in this case, I think that's more than sufficient. The judge was definitely aware of the issue both at that time and before, and could have called the jury back and made a curative instruction. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
You may. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Olson. You're up. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. At the introduction of the argument made in Governor Ventura's brief, we quoted from a Supreme Court case which said, courts should think hard and then think hard again before turning simple cases into hard ones. That admonition applies here. The jury's defamation verdict and the unjust enrichment award should both be affirmed because this is not a media defendant case. There are no constitutional issues this court need decide, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in instructing the jury or clearly err in its findings and conclusions on the unjust enrichment award. From the beginning, Governor Ventura alleged in his complaint that Chris Kyle fabricated a story about him, put it in a book, and then he went on radio, and he went on television, and he repeated it. And by repeating it, he defamed Governor Ventura. I don't have a lot of time here, so I'd like to jump right into some of the comments that Mr. Levine made. First and foremost, whether Governor Ventura needed to prove falsity by clear and convincing evidence or by a preponderance of the evidence. If we look at the estate's brief at 2, they admit that neither this court nor the Supreme Court has yet had occasion to make such a pronouncement explicitly. The First Amendment Scholar's amicus brief at page 16 admits that the Supreme Court has not definitively and expressly declared which standard should apply in actual malice cases. And I think I heard Mr. Levine admit that no U.S. Supreme Court, Eighth Circuit, or Minnesota court requires the higher standard. In fact, when the Supreme Court had a chance to look at it in the Hardy-Hanks case, it said we express no view on the issue, and they let the lower court's preponderance standard apply in that case. The Ninth and Second Circuits have looked at the issue, and in the Rattray case, a Ninth Circuit case from 1994, that court said the only circuit that has decided the question held that proof of the actual falsity of allegedly defamatory statements need only be proven by a preponderance of the evidence. There is nothing in New York Times versus Sullivan or elsewhere to support the novel theory that other elements of a defamation claim must be proved by clear and convincing evidence.
Is there some, and I seem to discern from appellant's argument that the interaction of the First Amendment in this case makes it appropriate to have the higher standard in a case like this as opposed to a garden variety defamation?
That may be an appropriate argument for a law review article or a commentary, but it's not the law. The Supreme Court has never declared that to be the law, and this circuit has never declared that to be the law. They can certainly argue if we read between the lines.
Why should we not make it the law?
Well, the Supreme Court had an opportunity to do it and didn't, and they've had several opportunities since then and didn't. And this case is not the one to present the argument.
As I recall, it's been a while since they looked, but as I recall, they didn't say it wasn't. They just said we're not going to address it. I mean, it wasn't saying it's preponderance of the evidence. They were just saying we're not going to address that now.
Correct. And by doing so, they allowed the lower court's preponderance standard to be the law of the land. They didn't change that. They didn't see occasion to change it, although the issue could have been addressed by them should the Supreme Court have decided it was important enough to look at that time. And since that time, they've never decided that a higher standard should apply. But in any event, they're urging this court to reach a constitutional issue that it need not reach at all, because the lower court, Judge Kyle, a very well-respected district judge, after sitting through 2 weeks of trial, observing the demeanor of the witnesses and listening to the testimony, said that falsity was, in fact, proved by clear and convincing evidence. In fact, there's a case that the estate relies on. It's cited in their brief. It's the DiBella versus Hopkins case. It involves the professional boxer Bernard Hopkins. It's a Second Circuit case from 2005. And that case is very instructive for the facts before this court, because in DiBella, the court specifically said that where Bernard Hopkins had alleged an HBO employee had demanded $50,000 to put a boxing match on television, $50,000 under the table, the promoter denied that. They went to trial, and the DiBella court said, where you have conflicting claims like that and the jury believes Mr. DiBella that he didn't demand a bribe, doesn't believe Mr. Hopkins and doesn't believe his witnesses, that's clear and convincing evidence. That's exactly what happened here. Governor Ventura testified this event was fabricated. It didn't occur, period. He brought three witnesses with him who all testified the event did not occur. It did not happen. They were there. Chris Kyle and his witnesses were found to be not credible, and they were found not to be believable. And there was a host of evidence, in addition to the witness testimony, which supports Governor Ventura's claim that the event never happened. We had a number of photographs. Chris Kyle claims that he assaulted Governor Ventura, a 220-pound trained killer who hit and experienced barroom brawler, who hit Governor Ventura straight in the face, right under the left eye. Yet all the pictures show not a mark, not a scratch, not a black eye, as Chris Kyle claimed. And the evidence goes on and on. It wasn't just one man's word against another. It was four witnesses the jury believed, Kyle's witnesses who were not believed, plus photographs, plus the absence of a police report, plus the absence of a hospital report, plus the absence of any other corroborating testimony. That is clear.
Let me ask you about, we talked a little bit about this earlier. I think Judge Smith may have brought it up. The questions the jury asked, and it's the exchange that occurs when the jury's asking about what's definition of serious doubt, and the exchange that the counsel had, and then the district court told the jury that it was their common sense, and the district court had told the lawyers that there was no binding definition. Seems to me there is a, I don't know if it's a binding, but there is a definition the courts have used for serious doubt. And my reading that is that common sense is not the definition. It's something higher than common sense. So why is not that alone a misinstruction of the jury?
Well, I think the argument itself is a misinstruction and a misinterpretation. Serious doubts is an alternative way to define actual malice. The Supreme Court has not itself defined serious doubts. Every chance that the Supreme Court has had to address the issue, it defines actual malice in alternative terms, starting with New York Times versus Sullivan, where they said knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard for the truth. Since then, the Hardy-Hanks course has said...
Well, didn't they say it's a high... I'm just trying to read my scribbled notes here. But a high degree of awareness of probable falsity, which seems to me higher than common sense... But go ahead. Why?
Sure. It's different, Your Honor. I'll acknowledge that. But what Hardy-Hanks said is that actual malice is proved if the defendant acted with a high degree of awareness of probable falsity or must have entertained serious doubts as to the truth of his publication. The Campbell Court, a case, also says high degree of awareness of probable falsity or that the defendant entertained serious doubts. The Mason case that Mr. Levine referenced, the defendant must have in fact entertained serious doubts as to the truth of his publication or acted with a high degree of awareness of probable falsity. So every time that the standard has been addressed, it's been addressed alternatively. Serious doubts has not been defined. And
I understand that if it were initial instructions, but here you have the jury coming back and asking specifically about that alternative. That's why I'm focusing you on that.
No, and I'm glad you do, Your Honor, because it's appropriate to point out at this time that when the instruction was first written and the term serious doubts appeared in it, the estate did not object, and they in fact conceded that the instruction was based on settled law because that was an acceptable alternative definition. And if the estate thinks that the jury struggled with the meaning of the term serious doubts, we can only imagine how it would have struggled if it had been instructed that you must find that Chris Kyle acted with a high degree of subjective awareness of probable falsity. The Supreme Court and this court have both endorsed the idea of instructing the juries in plain language.
Mr. Olson, did the jury need to find some specific falsities? How do we know from this record what they concluded was false? Was it the statements about some seals deserve to die, or was it statements about killing children? What do we know from the record or discern what the jury found to be false?
We do, Your Honor. And what they found to be false was the entire story written about Jesse Ventura. The claim pled, the claim tried, the claim argued at closing, and the claim described in the instructions was all the same. This incident, written about and talked about by Chris Kyle, did not occur.
Would it matter if certain specific elements alleged to be false were in fact true, if there was credible evidence that there was a true statement made, or not necessarily a true statement, but the actual statement made that Ventura represented that the certain seals or some seals deserve to die?
It would not, Your Honor, because, again, the claim was that the entire story was false. That's actually a higher burden that Governor Ventura had to prove. He didn't have to prove individual statements were false.
That means, and there was a discussion by the lawyers and the judge about the mixing and matching here of statements. The three statements, and I don't have them written down here, but the ones you were focused on, could the jury have found all three of those statements were not defaming, were not false, but find the story as a whole false?
The jury had to find that the statements were not made, which means that when Kyle said they were false, because the jury also had to find the more difficult and higher burden that the incident never occurred. If the incident never occurred, the statements could not have been made. And if they could not have been made when Kyle reported that they were, it was false, and he acted with actual malice because...
So you're saying we can make the conclusion that that's what the jury concluded based on that being the claim that you put forth?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what we're saying. The claim from day one, verbatim in the complaint, we had the entire story reprinted. We attached transcripts of Kyle's public repetition of the story. It was always the entire story. Governor Ventura testified flat out at trial. This event did not occur. There was no confrontation with Chris Kyle. I did not make any of these statements. He did not hit me. And I wasn't ridiculed, and I wasn't humiliated for showing up the next day at a naval graduation ceremony with a black eye. None of it happened, and that's what the jury found.
So to address the unjust enrichment issue and the apparent novelty of a claim like that in the context of defamatory statements.
Well, first, I think it's important for the court to understand that we believe the estate is making that argument to the wrong court because those arguments were waived below. The estate, well, first Chris Kyle and then the estate, each filed a summary judgment motion in this case. Neither of those motions argued that that unjust enrichment is precluded by an adequate remedy of law or that it's precluded by the First Amendment. Instead, the estate itself submitted pretrial proposed instructions on unjust enrichment, which parroted the elements of a claim under Minnesota law. It did not object to any of the unjust enrichment evidence at trial. And then before closing, the estate submitted revised instructions, which again parroted Minnesota law of unjust enrichment.
I thought they raised it like four times or more ahead of trial, including, I think, motions in limine or things like that.
In not one of those motions did the estate ever argue that unjust enrichment is precluded as a matter of law because Ventura has an adequate remedy or because unjust enrichment cannot be predicated on speech of public concern. Those arguments were never made until post-trial.
What about the argument that the unjust enrichment theory requires some other deliberate association or connection between the parties?
That
some quasi-contractual arrangement. Now, that was referenced in the motion for summary judgment. In fact, it's mentioned in the quote from the Ruzicki case that's in the motion for summary judgment.
Sure.
Do you agree that objection to the legal viability of the unjust enrichment claim was preserved and was made to the district court?
They made the argument based on Ruzicka, as I recall. They did not make the argument based on Caldas, which they have now brought before this court, the idea that there must be a pre-existing contractual or similar arrangement between the parties before a court can consider unjust enrichment. That one wasn't made. The Ruzicka argument that was made, they argued that as an element of unjust enrichment, Governor Ventura had to prove that somehow Chris Kyle used his name and his likeness for commercial purposes. But Ruzicka actually said is, in that case, it was the subject of a magazine article who had an alleged agreement with the reporter that her name wouldn't be used. The magazine gets published, the name is used. The court said in that case, you don't have a claim for unjust enrichment because your name wasn't used to promote the magazine article. Here, just the opposite occurred. Chris Kyle went on television, he went on radio, and he promoted his book and sales of his book incessantly with the controversy surrounding the claim that he punched Governor Ventura, and Governor Ventura made all of these vile statements.
Well, as Judge Smith said, this is kind of a unique to have this part of it. Why is it not, to the extent that their arguments were not raised, why is this not plain error? That this is just particularly in a, with all kinds of First Amendment issues floating around here, why is this not just plain error and a manifest injustice to allow?
On the First Amendment
on
issue?
On the unjust enrichment.
Well, it's not plain error because their arguments on the merits fail as well.
Pardon me?
Their arguments on the merits fail as well is why it's not plain error. There is no constitutional protection for defamatory speech. Gertz versus Robert Welch says that. United States versus Alvarez, a recent case from the U.S. Supreme Court, 2012.
Well, but I'm talking about that they had an adequate remedy. It's never been, you know, when, as far as I know, it's never been recognized anywhere before. Why is that something we shouldn't address now, even if it wasn't clearly raised to the district court?
Well, first, Governor Ventura had no adequate legal remedy at law because the recognized measure of damages for an appropriation claim, which is what they're arguing, that was the adequate remedy, rests on the fair value of Governor Ventura's name and likeness. In other words, what he lost, what he could have sold his name for. The jury found that he didn't prove that. We didn't have expert testimony on that issue. Unjust enrichment, in contrast, is measured by what the defendant gained. What are the unjust benefits that were conferred on the defendant?
Well, what about the requirement of a pre-existing association? Do you have a case, a Minnesota case, that would excuse that requirement?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
There are dozens of Minnesota cases that set out the elements of an unjust enrichment claim. Those were accurately captured in the jury instructions that the estate itself submitted. And in Minnesota, you're not required to have a pre-existing relationship. The case they're talking about is Caldas. In that case, a party brought a claim based on third-party beneficiary status to a contract. The court said, no, you're not really a third-party beneficiary. You're too far removed, and you're going to lose on your contract claim. But you can't go ahead and convert that loss on the contract claim into an unjust enrichment claim because we've never stretched it that far. Had you alleged a contract, maybe. But we're not going to stretch it that far to a third-party beneficiary. Okay. All of the other cases say that to get unjust enrichment in Minnesota, you need to only prove a couple of things. That a party was benefited under circumstances which made it unjust for him to profit, and that the benefit was conferred unknowingly and unwillingly. Unknowingly and unwillingly is the Galante versus Oz case, the Minnesota Court of Appeals case, 1986.
Okay, you're running out of time. I have a question related to that, which is, how did the court arrive at the dollar amount? It seems, from my quick looking at it, that 25% of the earnings was pulled out of the air. What's the foundation that you have in the record to support that number?
Well, first, the court never said it's going to be 25%. The court observed on the back end that the amount awarded was approximately 25%.
I know. It was agreeing with the jury, but still the court has to make an independent assessment.
Sure. And in my 30 seconds left, I can give you the quick summary. The defamatory story caused an unknown first-time author who had never written a book before, caused that book to rocket to number one in 3 days, propelled by the amount of media coverage it received. The book generated $6 million in royalties, the evidence of which came in through Chris Kyle's and the estate's own witnesses without objection, and it was all unrebutted. The law in Minnesota is that equity will not permit a tortfeasor to benefit by receiving a windfall. And the law also says that once damages have been proved, the difficulty of proving the exact amount will not preclude recovery. So based on all of the evidence, go ahead.
Okay, I understand. You're now telling me platitudes. I know those. Let's go to the insurance issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's my other question. The statement in the closing about companies and companies insurers on the hook if you find that the plaintiff was defamed. First of all, the issue came up, but people didn't know anything about it. And here you have you've taken a statement, essentially say that it makes clear that they're going to say, well, the insurance company is going to pay for this. And while it says defamed, it's arguably the jury could think the insurance company would pay for any judgment. Why isn't that entitled them to a mistrial and everything?
First, we believe the argument
and
was waived.
I understand it's one phrase out of a long trial, and lawyers get in the heat of the moment, and sometimes they step over the line. But in my opinion, with a little bit of experience, is that was over the line. Now, tell me why we shouldn't grant a mistrial for that.
Well, first, they waived the argument because they didn't object during closing argument and allow a curative instruction. And second, the quote that they keep bringing up in their briefs in an oral argument is a conveniently cropped quote. If you read what I actually said, it wasn't heat of the moment, and it was carefully considered, and it was carefully considered to be in line with exactly what Judge Kyle permitted me to do at trial. What I said was, referring to a HarperCollins witness, a publisher's employee's witness, it's hard to believe that this witness sat on the stand and told you that he doesn't know his company is on the hook because the insurance is referenced in the publishing contract, which is in evidence, and which he sat on the stand and told you that he read. It was purely for the issue of bias.
Do you have any case where the witness that you're looking for bias is not an employee of the insurance company, that this is an employee of a company that's insured, that the insured is paying the party in the lawsuit? This is fairly attenuated from the typical case where an investigator for State Farm Insurance goes out and does some investigation, come in, you ask him about it. State Farm's on the hook. But do you have any case where it's that far removed from the typical situation?
I can't recite case citations off the top of my head, but I do recall specifically that the estate has no cases for the opposite proposition, that Rule 411 of the Federal Rule of Evidence is limited to that extent. We briefed this before go ahead.
I'll suggest to you that it's because it's not been done, that they have something that separated that far away from the party. But I'd be happy if you've got a case like that. I authorize you to send a 28J and send it in, because that troubles me that this is so far removed from the typical case that Rule 411 is designed to handle that. It just troubles me. So if you can find a case, please let us know.
And I can give you two cases right now, not exactly on that point, but I think they'll be helpful to you. The first is cited in the estate's brief. It's Griffin versus Hilke, an Eighth Circuit case from 1986. At note 2, that case says, the parties do not dispute that the police made a timely objection to the alleged prejudicial argument. And that was noted for the idea that if no timely objection, i.e. during the closing argument, is made, it's waived. The second case, Ouachita National Bank, also a case from this court, 1982. Which says that there is no prejudice from the mention of insurance because the jurors already knew that the defendant carried insurance. Here, they knew that because they had the publishing agreement. I would have been permitted to read from that publishing agreement during closing argument, but I made a decision not to do that because I didn't want to cross the line.
It's on page 13 of the agreement, and it does refer to, I think they use the language may. They may cover him if there is insurance. And the only way you make it relevant is to put in evidence that there is insurance, and then we're right back in the same circle again. You'd be putting on evidence that there was insurance. So, if you've got something in particular, I'm familiar with all that, but if you've got something where you can show a court has authorized inquiry into these things where you have the insurance coverage of the witness you're inquiring about so removed. You know, this is not the typical case where that comes up.
And we'd be happy to do that, Your Honor. And okay. My time was up some time ago. And
yeah, you got plenty of time there. Okay, thank you.
I appreciate you allowing me to make an additional comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Levine, we'll give you a minute and a half here.
Thank you, Your Honor. A lot of things to address. I'll try to do them quickly. First, with respect to material falsity, I argued the Hart-Hanks case in the Supreme Court, and although I was not counsel in the lower courts, there was not only no evidence that the defendant ever requested a clear and convincing evidence instruction with respect to material falsity at trial, but I can attest to the fact that no such issue was raised before the Sixth Circuit or raised before the Supreme Court, either in the cert petition or on the merits. If anything, therefore, the court's sua sponte decision in Hart-Hanks to flag the issue in its own decision bespeaks a desire to alert lower courts and litigants alike that it was not endorsing the instruction as given by the trial judge. And that case, Hart-Hanks, was decided 3 years before Mason and Eyre, Wisconsin, both of which we submit all but hold that clear and convincing evidence is required for material falsity. Second, on the issue related to Judge Smith's question about how do we know whether this jury found liability based on something that was true, that raises the entire problem of instruction number 8. If you look at instruction number 8, you will see that the court correctly instructed the jury that this claim was limited to the 3 statements that Mr. Ventura alleged were false and defamatory. When the jury came back with its question saying, are we limited to the 3 statements? Are those the only things that we're supposed to find the elements of defamation with respect to? Or are we supposed to make some generalized finding with respect to the entire story? The judge changed his mind and in his response to the jury's questions switched gears and said, no, you make your decision with respect to the whole story, not with respect to just the 3 statements. Look at the story as a whole. And the thing he sent back to the jury had as a whole underlined. That meant that the jury could very easily have found that the punch, which Mr. Ventura conceded was not defamatory and could not be the basis for a cause of action as a matter of law because, among other things, Minnesota doesn't recognize the tort of false light invasion of privacy, but they could have based the finding in favor of Mr. Ventura on the fact that the punch statement was false, and although the actual statements about deserving to lose a few and alike were true, they were nevertheless defamatory. And that's another reason why this judgment has to be reversed, and at very least there be a new trial.
Okay, your time's expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. It's obviously a very interesting case. You've all done well. We thank you for your arguments, both in brief form and in oral argument today. So we will take it under advisement. Thank you.